You know, when we think about getting paid, we usually fixate on that salary number, don't we?
Absolutely, it's the headline figure.
But here's something wild. Your benefits, you know, health, life, disability stuff, that package can easily be like 30% or even more of your total compensation.
It's a huge chunk. Really underlines how vital these benefits are now. They're not just perks anymore.
No way. They're fundamental. Which actually brings us nicely to our topic today, something a lot of you asked about. Group insurance. We're going deep. Think of this as your fast track to understanding, you know, what it is, why it matters so much in today's workplace, and maybe some surprising bits about its history and where things are heading.
Right. And for this, we've pulled together quite a bit of material. We're looking at the core principles, the history, the regulations, which are key, and what's happening in the market right now.
Yeah, our mission today, pretty simple. We want to give you a clear, solid grasp of the important stuff about group insurance. Get those aha moments without, you know, drowning you in details.
Exactly. Valuable insights keep it manageable.
Okay, let's jump in. At its absolute core, what is group insurance?
Well, the fundamental idea is actually pretty straightforward. It's about pooling risk.
Okay.
You get a large group of people, say all the employees at a company, together under one policy. Because the risk is spread out across many people, the insurer can offer better terms than you or I could likely get trying to buy coverage on our own.
Strength in numbers.
Precisely. And it's not just about lower premiums, though that's a big part. It can also mean, you know, easier access to get coverage in the first place, admin efficiencies, and even flexibility to tailor the plan a bit.
Right. Makes sense. So why has this become such a cornerstone? I mean, every job ad shouts about the benefits package.
It really has shifted, hasn't it? Group benefits are now seen as, well, essential, a core part of the deal. When you're weighing job offers, honestly, the quality of the benefits can be just as big a factor as the salary itself.
Especially with healthcare costs being what they are.
Exactly. That's a huge driver. Employer plans often give you a level of affordability and, frankly, comprehensive coverage that's really hard to replicate on the individual market.
Okay. And it's not just some abstract system, right? There are actual people, professionals designing these things.
Oh, definitely. Insurance pros who specialize in group benefits, they play a really significant role. They're the ones helping employers figure out, design, and implement these programs.
So they're impacting a lot of people's lives.
Directly. Financial security, access to health care, quality of life. It's a big responsibility.
Okay, so we get the what and the why now, but where did this whole concept even start? Did it always look like this?
Not at all. The very earliest forms were simpler, mostly focused on life insurance and maybe some basic accident coverage. But the big turning point, especially for group health insurance, was World War II.
World War II. How so?
Well, the government had put wage controls in place, you know, trying to stop inflation during the war. Companies couldn't just offer higher salaries to compete for workers.
Ah, okay. So they couldn't compete on wages.
Exactly. But the wage controls didn't apply to benefits. So companies started offering better benefits packages as a way to attract and keep employees in a really tight labor market.
Clever workaround.
And then came the other shoe drop. In 1943, the IRS ruled that the money employers spent on employee health plan premiums was tax exempt for the employer, and the benefits weren't taxable income for the employee.
Wow, that's
It
huge.
was a game changer. Suddenly, providing health insurance became much more tax efficient for everyone involved. That ruling really poured fuel on the fire for employer-sponsored health coverage growth.
So a war and a tax ruling basically shaped the system we have today. That's kind of amazing. What happened after the war ended? Did things just plateau?
No, things kept expanding. Disability insurance, for instance, became much more common. Protecting income if you couldn't work due to illness or injury, that became really important.
Makes sense.
Then, in the 50s, you started seeing dedicated dental plans emerge. People realized dental care had its own set of needs and costs, separate from general medical.
Right, fillings aren't quite the same as surgery.
Exactly. And vision benefits followed a similar path not long after. Again, recognizing that routine eye exams and glasses weren't really covered well under standard health plans. This whole trend kind of set the stage for the voluntary benefits we see now.
So a growing recognition of specific needs beyond just basic medical. What about the government? You mentioned Medicare and Medicaid earlier.
Right. The 1960s were huge with Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for lower income individuals. Now, while they serve specific groups, their creation had ripples across the entire private insurance market.
How so?
They essentially set certain benchmarks, certain standards for coverage and administration that private insurers then kind of had to respond to or align with. It influenced the whole industry.
Okay, so government action raised the bar. Now regulations, we hear so much about them. What were the big milestones after that?
The 70s and 80s brought some foundational changes. First, ERISA in 1974, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act.
ERISA, hear that one a lot.
You do.
Yeah.
It was massive. It set federal minimum standards for most private industry health and pension plans. Things like reporting rules, disclosure to employees, fiduciary duties, basically, making sure employers manage these benefit funds responsibly. It fundamentally changed how plans were structured and run.
So adding a layer of protection and oversight.
Precisely. Then, fast forward to 1985, you get COBRA, the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act.
Continuation coverage.
That's the one. It gave employees and families the right to continue their group health coverage for a limited time after losing a job or other qualifying events, a vital safety net for many people during transitions.
Definitely. And then IPAT.
IPAT came along in 1996. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It had two main thrusts. Making it easier to keep coverage when changing jobs, especially addressing pre-existing conditions, and establishing crucial rules for protecting the privacy and security of your health information.
Portability and privacy.
Got it. So, quite the journey from simple life insurance to this regulated complex system. You mentioned voluntary benefits fitting in here too.
Yeah, throughout this whole period, voluntary benefits just kept gaining traction. These are the coverages employees usually pay for themselves, maybe with a small employer contribution.
Like critical illness or accident insurance.
Exactly. Critical illness, accident, hospital indemnity plans. At first, they were maybe seen as small add-ons.
Yeah.
But as employer costs for core benefits, especially health, kept rising, voluntary benefits became more strategic.
How so?
Well, employers facing cost pressures could still offer a way for employees to get broader protection. These voluntary plans evolved, becoming more sophisticated ways for you to fill specific gaps or cover financial risks that your main plans might not fully address. They offer customization without a huge hit to the employer's budget.
A way to personalize protection. Okay, fascinating history. Let's pivot to today. What's the group insurance landscape look like right now? What are the big forces at play? Oh, unquestionably, the dominant force is the relentless rise in healthcare costs. It overshadows almost everything else.
We certainly feel that.
Medical inflation has been outpacing general inflation for years, decades even, just to put a number on it. The average annual premium for an employer-sponsored family health plan in 2023, around $23,600.
Wow.
And get this, that's more than a 250% increase since the year 2000. It's just staggering pressure on budgets both for employers and employees.
Yeah, no kidding. So what are employers doing to cope? They can't just absorb that forever.
They're trying various things. We're definitely seeing more cost sharing. That means higher deductibles for employees, higher copays for doctor visits or prescriptions, and employees paying a larger slice of the monthly premium.
Shifting more of the cost.
And alongside that, there's been a huge surge in high deductible health plans, often paired with those health savings accounts, HSA.
Right, the HDHPs and HSA.
Yeah, back in the mid-2000s, maybe less than 5% of workers had them. Now, it's closer to 30%.
And the thinking there is give employees more skin in the game, more control over spending, but also means more upfront costs for them.
That's the idea, yes. And another major trend, kind of related, is the continued growth of self-funding.
We touched on that, employers taking on the risks themselves.
Exactly. It used to be just the domain of huge corporations, but now we're seeing mid-sized companies, even some smaller ones, maybe 25, 50 employees moving to self-funded arrangements.
Really? Why the shift down market?
A few reasons. More control over plan design is a big one. Also, potential cost savings if their employee group is relatively healthy. And frankly, avoiding certain ACA requirements that apply specifically to fully insured plans can be a motivator too. Plus, potentially lower administrative costs.
Interesting. So, taking on risk for potential reward and control. What else is shaping things?
Demographics are playing a huge role. We've got like five generations in the workforce now. Traditionalists, boomers, Gen X, millennials, Gen Z.
Wow.
And they all have different needs, different expectations for benefits, even different ways they want to learn about and enroll in them. Communicating effectively becomes a real challenge.
Tailoring becomes key.
Absolutely. And that ties back into the remarkable growth of voluntary benefits we mentioned. Critical illness, accident, hospital indemnity, legal plans, pet insurance, identity theft. It's a long list.
The benefit buffet.
Kind of.
Yeah.
It lets employees tailor their protection to their specific worries without necessarily piling huge costs onto the employer. And of course, technology. That's transforming everything.
How so?
Online enrollment platforms, tools that help you decide which plan is best for you, mobile apps to check your coverage or find a doctor, and the explosion of telemedicine virtual doctor visits.
Telemedicine's definitely gone mainstream.
Yeah.
Any recent rule changes we should know about?
Yeah, a couple of big ones. The No Surprises Act, which kicked in January 2022, aimed at protecting people from those unexpected massive bills you sometimes get from out-of-network providers in emergencies.
That's a relief for many, I bet.
Definitely. And we're also seeing lots of action at the state level. Things like paid family leave mandates popping up in more states and various state efforts trying to tackle prescription drug pricing. It creates a complex patchwork for employers operating in multiple states.
Right. Adds another layer of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a really dynamic picture. Let's drill down into the plans themselves. When you get your enrollment packet, what are the main types of health plans you usually see?
Generally, you'll encounter three main models: PPOs, HMOs, and POS plans.
Okay, PPO first. Preferred Provider Organization.
Right. PPOs have a network of doctors and hospitals they've contracted with, usually getting you lower rates if you stay in network. The key feature is flexibility. You typically can go out of network, but you'll pay significantly more. And usually, you don't need to pick a primary care physician or PCP, and you don't need referrals to see specialists.
So, more freedom, potentially higher costs if you go outside the lines.
Got it. What about HMOs? Health Maintenance Organizations. HMOs work a bit differently. They often emphasize co-payments, those fixed dollar amounts, like $30 for a visit rather than big deductibles.
Mm.
You usually do need to choose a PCP from their network, and that PCP acts as your gatekeeper, providing referrals if you need to see a specialist within the HMO's network.
So more managed, potentially more predictable costs with those copays, but less freedom to just go see anyone.
That's generally the trade-off. And HMOs can structure their doctor relationships differently. Some employ doctors directly, others contract with large groups or networks of independent practices. That can sometimes affect the range of doctors available to you.
Okay. And the third type, POS, point of service.
POS plans are kind of a hybrid. They try to blend features of HMOs and PPOs. Like an HMO, you typically pick a PCP and need referrals for the best coverage level. But like a PPO, they usually offer some coverage if you decide to go out of network, though again, it'll cost you more than staying in network.
A middle ground, maybe.
Why?
Some flexibility, but still encouraging coordination through a PCP.
Exactly. It tries to strike that balance.
Got it. Different structures, different rules. Now, we talked about cost sharing being a big trend. What are the main ways those costs get divvied up?
Well, besides the monthly premium you pay,
right,
the big ones are deductibles, copayments, and coinsurance. The deductible is that amount you have to shell out for covered services before your insurance starts paying its share.
And those are going up, you said?
Significantly. The average deductible for single coverage has more than doubled in the past decade or so. Mm-hmm. It can be a hefty sum.
Yeah. Okay, what about copays and coinsurance?
Copayments are those fixed amounts for specific services, like $30 for a primary care visit, $50 for a specialist, maybe $15 for a generic drug. Simple, predictable for that service.
Okay.
Coinsurance is different. It's a percentage of the cost that you pay after you've met your deductible. So a common setup is 80-20%. The insurance pays 80% of the allowed amount, and you pay 20%.
So the insurance takes most of it, but you still have a piece.
Exactly. And all these levers, premiums, deductibles, copays, coinsurance, can be adjusted by employers and insurers to manage overall plan costs.
Lots of moving parts. You mentioned HSAs again. How do they fit into this cost-sharing picture specifically?
HSAs, health savings accounts, are really unique tools. They're designed specifically to be paired with those high-deductible health plans.
Right.
The magic is the triple tax advantage. Money goes in pre-tax, it grows tax-free, and you can take it out tax-free for qualified medical expenses. It's a powerful incentive.
Triple tax. Yeah, that sounds good.
For 2024, to be HSA eligible, the plan's minimum deductible has to be at least $1,600 for an individual or $3,200 for a family. And there are maximums on your total out-of-pocket spending, too.
Okay.
And there are limits on how much you can contribute each year. For 2024, it's $4,150 for individuals, $8,300 for families, plus an extra $1,000 catch-up if you're 55 or older.
And the best part is, that money is yours.
Absolutely. It rolls over year after year, no use it or lose it. And it's portable. You take it with you if you change jobs. You can even invest the funds once the balance reaches a certain level. It becomes a savings vehicle, not just for today's costs, but for healthcare down the road, even in retirement.
That's a key difference. Okay, besides these cost-sharing mechanisms, are employers using other strategies to manage health costs?
Yes, definitely. Disease management programs are becoming much more common.
What are those?
They focus on helping people who have chronic conditions like diabetes, asthma, heart disease. The programs offer support, education, care coordination, things to help individuals manage their condition better day to day.
And the goal is?
Improve health outcomes, definitely. But also, by helping people stay healthier and avoid complications or hospital stays, these programs can significantly reduce overall healthcare costs for the employer and the employee in the long run. It's a win-win, ideally.
Better health, lower costs. Makes sense. Okay, let's switch gears slightly to funding. We touched on fully insured versus self-funded. Can you break that down a bit more?
Sure. Fully insured is probably the most common model, especially for smaller businesses. The employer basically buys an insurance policy from a carrier like Blue Cross or Aetna. They pay a fixed premium per employee.
And the insurance company handles everything.
The insurance company assumes all the financial risk. If claims are higher than expected, the insurer takes the hit. If they're lower, the insurer keeps the difference. The premium is usually set for a year. Predictable, less risk for the employer.
Okay. Straightforward. So what's self-funding?
In a self-funded or self-insured plan, the employer takes on the direct financial risk for paying employee medical claims. They essentially act like their own insurance company for their employees.
Whoa, that sounds risky.
It can be, which is why they don't usually handle it all themselves. They typically hire a third-party administrator, a TPA, to manage the plan process claims, handle the provider network, etc. And crucially, most self-funded employers buy stop-loss insurance.
Stop-loss, like a safety net.
Exactly. There are two main types. Specific stop-loss protects the employer against a single catastrophic claim on one individual exceeding a certain high dollar amount. Aggregate stop loss protects the employer if the total claims for the entire group go above a certain expected level for the year.
Ah, okay. So they cover the predictable claims, but have insurance for the unpredictable extremes. Why do this?
Several potential advantages, especially for larger or mid-sized employers. More control over the plan design. They can customize benefits more freely. Potential for cost savings if their group's claims are lower than what a fully insured premium would have been. They get to keep that surplus. And, as mentioned, self-funded plans are generally exempt from state insurance mandates and some ACA rules, which can offer more flexibility and potentially lower costs.
So more control, potential savings, but also more direct financial risk and volatility.
That's the trade-off. It requires careful financial management and risk tolerance.
Are there options in between, not just all or nothing?
Oh, yeah. It's not strictly black and white. There are hybrid arrangements. Minimum premium plans, for example, where the employer self-funds claims up to a certain point and then insurance kicks in. Dividend-eligible, fully insured plans might return some money to the employer if claims are low. And level-funded plans are gaining popularity, especially for smaller groups. They offer predictable monthly payments like a fully insured plan. But the employer can still potentially get money back if claims are favorable.
So a whole spectrum based on how much risk an employer wants to take. Okay, we've hit medical hard. What about protecting income? Disability insurance. What are the basics there?
Disability is crucial. It replaces a portion of your income if you can't work due to illness or injury. There are two main types, short-term disability, STD, and long-term disability, LTD.
Okay, let's start with STD. Short-term. How short?
Typically, STD benefits last for a limited period, often around 13 to 26 weeks, maybe up to a year in some plans. It's designed to cover those initial months off work.
And it replaces your full income.
Usually a percentage, often 60% or so, up to a weekly maximum benefit amount. Many plans also have provisions for partial disability, supporting you if you can return to work part-time or with modified duties as you recover.
That gradual return sounds helpful. Does it matter why you're disabled?
It generally covers non-work-related illnesses or injuries. Work-related stuff is typically covered by workers' compensation.
Right. How does STD interact with other things, like if you qualify for Social Security disability?
Good question. Most STD plans integrate benefits. That means the benefit amount might be reduced by other income you receive while disabled, like Social Security disability insurance, SSDI, workers' comp, or state disability benefits. The goal is to prevent your total replacement income from exceeding a certain percentage, like maybe 70 or 80% of your pre-disability earnings.
Okay. Avoid stacking benefits too high. How are these funded? Same options.
Yep. Similar to health, fully insured, where the employer pays a premium, self-funded, where the employer pays the benefits directly, or some kind of hybrid.
And taxes. If I get STD benefits, do I pay TOFs on them?
It depends on who paid the premium. If your employer paid the premium for your STD coverage, then yes, the benefits you receive are generally considered taxable income. But if you paid the premiums yourself, usually with after-tax dollars through payroll deduction, then the benefits you receive are typically tax-free. That's a pretty significant difference in the net amount you actually get.
Definitely something to be aware of. Okay, now LTD, long-term disability. What's different?
LTD kicks in after your STD benefits run out, or after a longer waiting period, called the elimination period, often 90 or 180 days. It's for disabilities that last much longer.
How long can LTD benefits last?
It varies by plan, but often they can continue for several years, or even until your normal retirement age, like 65 or 67, depending on the plan terms and when your disability began.
Wow, that's significant income protection. Does it also cover partial disability?
Yes. Good LTD plans usually include residual or partial disability provisions, similar to STD, to support returning to work gradually or in a different, lower-paying occupation if necessary.
Are there reasons LTD might not pay? Exclusions.
Yes. Common exclusions are similar to STD. Disabilities from self-inflicted injuries, war, committing a felony. Occupational disabilities covered by workers' comp are usually excluded, too. And pre-existing condition limitations are common.
Pre-existing conditions. How does that work?
There's usually a look-back period. If you received treatment for a condition within, say, 3 or 6 months before your coverage started, and then you become disabled due to that same condition within a certain period after coverage starts, often 12 months, the plan might not cover that disability or might delay coverage for it. However, IPAIR rules limit how these can be applied in group health plans, and initial enrollment often has guaranteed issue up to certain limits. It's more common in disability and critical illness.
So a temporary window where past conditions might affect coverage. Does LTD also integrate with Social Security?
Absolutely. Integration with SSDI is a key feature of almost all LTD plans. Your LTD benefit is typically reduced by the amount you receive from Social Security disability. Many LTD carriers even provide assistance to help you apply for SSDI, since approval reduces their payout. It also integrates with workers' comp, retirement benefits if you start drawing them early, etc.
Makes sense. You mentioned retirement. How does LTD interact with that longer-term picture?
That's an important consideration. Being out of work long-term can devastate retirement savings. Some more robust LTD plans have features to help with this. For instance, some might continue making contributions to your 401k or pension plan while you're on LTD.
Really? That's amazing.
It's a great feature if available. Others might offer a separate retirement security type benefit, perhaps a lump sum paid at retirement age, to help make up for lost savings years.
Things to look for in the fine print. Funding and taxes for LTD, same as STD.
Pretty much the same principles apply. Employer-paid premiums mean taxable benefits. Employee-paid premiums, with after-tax dollars, mean tax-free benefits. You also see core plus buy-up options, where the employer provides a base level of taxable coverage, and you can buy additional tax-free coverage on top.
Okay, so disability covers income. Let's move beyond that. Dental and vision. Pretty standard offerings these days. What's typical for dental insurance?
Dental plans usually have tiered coverage, think categories, preventative, basic, major, and sometimes orthodontics.
Preventive is like cleanings and exams.
Exactly. And that's often covered at the highest level, maybe 80% or even 100%, sometimes with no deductible. They want you to get those checkups.
Makes sense. Basic and major.
Basic might be things like fillings, maybe simple extractions. Coverage might be around 80%. Major services are more complex, crowns, bridges, dentures, root canals. Coverage here is typically lower, maybe 50%. And orthodontics, like braces, if covered, often has a separate lifetime maximum benefit, not just an annual one.
Are there annual limits on dental?
Yes, very common. A typical annual maximum might be $1,000, $1,500, maybe $2,500 per person. Once the plan has paid out that much in a year, you're usually on the hook for the rest.
And deductibles.
Often, yes. But they usually apply only to basic and major services, not preventative. And coinsurance applies too, where you pay that percentage, like 20% for basic, 50% for major, after the deductible.
Networks matter in dental too, PPOs.
Definitely. PPO dental plans are the most common. You save money by going to dentists in the network. HMO dental plans exist, sometimes called DHMOs or capitated plans, but they're less common and usually require you to use specific dentists. And there's that growing awareness now of the link between oral health and overall health, like gum disease and heart conditions, which is starting to influence plan design a bit.
Interesting connection. Okay, vision insurance. Simpler.
Generally, yes. Vision plans tend to be more standardized. Usually they cover an eye exam once a year, often with just a small copay, like $10 or $20.
Okay, exams covered. What about glasses or contacts?
They provide allowances for materials, usually every 12 or 24 months. For frames, you might get a $130 or $150 allowance, and you pay the difference if you choose more expensive ones. For lenses, there are often copays that might vary based on the lens type, single vision, bifocals, progressives, coatings.
In contacts.
Usually, instead of the glasses benefit, you can opt for an allowance towards contact lenses, often a similar amount to the frame lens benefit. Some plans distinguish between cosmetic contacts and medically necessary ones, sometimes offering a higher benefit for the latter.
So it helps offset the cost of keeping your prescription up to date. How are dental and vision usually paid for? Employer or employee?
It varies. Sometimes the employer covers the whole cost or shares it, but very often, especially for vision, these are offered as voluntary benefits where the employee pays the full premium. The premiums are often quite low, maybe $5, $15 a month for individual vision, $15, $30 for family, making them pretty popular add-ons.
Affordable way to get that specific coverage. Okay, let's talk about those other specialized voluntary coverages. Critical illness, accident, hospital indemnity. What problems do they solve?
These are designed to provide cash benefits directly to you in specific situations, helping cover costs that your main health insurance might not, like deductibles, copays, travel for treatment, or even just lost income or regular bills.
Okay, so critical illness first.
Critical illness insurance pays a lump sum cash benefit if you're diagnosed with a specific covered serious illness. Think major things like cancer, heart attack, stroke, kidney failure, major organ transplant. The list of covered conditions is spelled out in the policy.
A direct cash payment upon diagnosis?
Usually, yes, although there's often a short survival period requirement, maybe 14 or 30 days after diagnosis before the benefit pays out. And the diagnosis usually needs to meet specific criteria outlined in the policy.
Is it hard to qualify for? Underwriting.
In group settings, during initial enrollment, there's often guaranteed issue up to certain benefit amounts, meaning no health questions asked. Higher amounts might require some medical underwriting. Premiums are usually based on age, and there might be temporary pre-existing condition limitations.
And the cash is mine to use how I want. Taxes.
Generally, yes, the cash is unrestricted. If you pay the premium with after-tax dollars, the benefit is typically tax-free. If the employer pays, it's usually taxable.
Okay. Accident insurance. How's that different?
Accident insurance pays benefits based on specific injuries received or treatments needed due to an accident. It's not a lump sum for a diagnosis, but rather scheduled payments for services.
Like what?
Things like a payment for a fracture, a dislocation, a burn, an ER visit due to accident, ambulance transport, hospitalization per day due to accident, physical therapy sessions. The policy lists specific injuries treatments and the dollar amount paid for each.
So it helps cover the immediate cost from getting hurt. Guaranteed issue too.
Usually yes, in group plans. Common exclusions would be self-inflicted injuries, injuries while intoxicated or committing a crime, or maybe from specific hazardous activities. Family coverage is usually available too.
Okay. And hospital indemnity. Sounds like it pays if you're hospitalized.
Exactly. Hospital indemnity plans pay a fixed dollar amount for each day you're confined in a hospital. Sometimes there's an initial payment just for being admitted, then a per day amount.
For any reason, illness or injury.
Usually covers both, although some plans might have a waiting period before covering hospital stays due to illness, but not injury. Like accident plans, they're often guaranteed issue in group settings, though pre-existing condition limits might apply, especially regarding illness. Pregnancy is often covered, but might have specific waiting periods too.
I could see how that would help with a high deductible plan.
Precisely. The cash can help cover that deductible or other out-of-pocket costs when you have a hospital stay. Some plans also include benefits for stays in skilled nursing facilities or rehab, or even for outpatient surgery.
And taxes similar to critical illness.
Yes. Same principle. Employee-paid after-tax premiums generally lead to tax-free benefits. Employer-paid leads to taxable benefits. The claims process for these is usually pretty straightforward, too, which people appreciate.
Good supplementary coverages. Okay, thinking longer term, what about long-term care insurance and HSAs for future planning?
Long-term care, or LTC, insurance is specifically designed to cover the costs of custodial care, help with daily living activities like bathing, dressing, eating if you have a chronic illness or cognitive impairment, like Alzheimer's.
Stuff Medicare doesn't really cover.
Exactly. Medicare and regular health insurance primarily cover skilled medical care, not this ongoing assistance with daily life, which can be incredibly expensive over months or years. LTC insurance fills that gap.
How do the benefits work?
Policies pay a certain amount, often a daily or monthly maximum, for covered services like home care, assisted living, nursing home care. You choose a benefit period, maybe 2 years, 5 years, or even lifetime. Inflation protection is a really critical feature to look for, so your benefit keeps pace with rising care costs over time.
Is it hard to get? Underwriting.
Individual LTC policies typically involve pretty comprehensive medical underwriting. Group LTC plans offered through employers often have more simplified underwriting, maybe guaranteed or modified guaranteed issue, especially during initial enrollment.
Something to consider, especially as we age. And HSAs for the long term. We talked about them with HGHPs.
Right. But their power really shines over the long haul. Because that money grows tax-free and rolls over, an HSA can become a significant asset for funding healthcare costs in retirement, which can be one of the biggest expenses people face.
Using it like a retirement health fund.
Precisely. You can invest the funds, potentially growing the balance substantially over decades. Then, in retirement, you can withdraw funds tax-free for Medicare premiums, long-term care premiums, and other qualified medical expenses. It's a fantastic tool for that specific future need. Just remember, you can't contribute to an HSA once you enroll in Medicare, but you can certainly use the funds you've already accumulated.
So build it up while working, use it tax-free later.
Got it. What about those other accounts, FSAs? Flexible spending accounts, how do they compare?
FSAs are also tax-advantaged accounts, but they work differently. There's the healthcare FSA, which you use for out-of-pocket medical, dental, and vision expenses.
Uh-huh.
For 2024, the contribution limit is $3,200.
Okay.
There's also a limited-purpose FSA, just for dental and vision, which you can have alongside an HSA, and a dependent care FSA for eligible child care or elder care expenses that allow you to work.
The big difference is the use it or lose it thing, right?
That's the main one. Generally, you have to spend the money you contribute to an FSA within the plan year. Employers can offer either a limited rollover, around $640 for 2024, or a grace period of a couple of months into the next year to use up funds. But otherwise, unspent money is forfeited.
So you need to estimate your expenses carefully. Exactly. And FSAs aren't usually portable like HSAs. If you leave your job mid-year, your FSA eligibility typically ends, although you might be able to continue a healthcare FSA through COBRA temporarily. They're great for predictable near-term expenses, while HSAs excel for long-term savings and uncertainty.
Good distinction. Okay, shifting back to the insurer's perspective, how do they decide who to cover in a group and what to charge? Underwriting and renewal.
Underwriting is all about assessing risks and setting the price, the premium. Group underwriting is different from individual. Instead of scrutinizing your personal health history, they look at the characteristics of the entire group age, gender mix, location, industry, and critically past claims experience if available.
So the group's track record matters more than any one person's health.
For larger groups, definitely. That's called experience rating. Premiums are based heavily on how much the group actually spent on claims in prior years. For smaller groups, insurers might use more community rating or prospective rating based on projected costs for similar groups. Retrospective rating is another approach, usually for large groups, where the final premium gets adjusted up or down after the year based on actual claims.
Okay. What about guaranteed issue? Does everyone get in?
In most group plans, yes. During initial enrollment periods, coverage is guaranteed issue up to certain limits, meaning no medical questions asked. This is key for making group insurance accessible. However, if you enroll late, or if you want very high amounts of coverage, like extra life insurance, you might have to provide evidence of insurability, like answering health questions.
And pre-existing conditions, you mentioned those limitations.
Right. Particularly for disability and critical illness, plans often have temporary pre-existing condition clauses, as we discussed, but HIPAA heavily restricts their use in group health plans, ensuring people aren't locked out of coverage due to past health issues when they join a new group plan.
So protections exist. What happens at renewal time each year?
Renewal is a critical process. The insurer proposes rates for the next year, usually based on the group's experience and projected future costs. The employer then has decisions to make. They're balancing financial sustainability. Can we afford this? With ensuring the coverage still meets employee needs, improving administration, keeping employees participating, and maintaining continuity.
Lots to juggle.
It involves comparing the renewal offer to the broader market, negotiating with the current carrier, maybe considering changes to plan design or cost sharing, or even exploring different funding approaches like self-funding. And evaluating how well the plan performed after renewal is crucial too.
A constant cycle. Now the regulations, we've mentioned ERISA, COBRA, HIPAA, ACA, it sounds like a regulatory maze.
It can feel that way. You've got layers of rules. Historically, states were the primary regulators of insurance itself, the McGarren-Ferguson Act. But federal law has increasingly stepped into the employee benefits space.
So state laws govern the insurance companies, but federal laws govern the benefit plans.
That's a good general way to think about it, though there's overlap. ERISA sets federal standards for plan administration, fiduciary duties, disclosure, and claims procedures for most private employer plans, both insured and self-funded. COBRA provides those federal continuation rights. HIBIS sets federal rules for portability and privacy. The ACA added numerous federal mandates specifically for health plans covering preventive care, no lifetime limits, out-of-pocket maximums, employer shared responsibility rules, the employer mandate, etc.
So federal law is very dominant now for health benefits.
For health benefits, yes, federal law, ERISA, ELO, EPA, COBRA, sets a very significant framework, especially for self-funded plans, which ERISA largely shields from state insurance laws. However, state insurance laws still heavily regulate fully insured plans, setting rules on mandated benefits like coverage for autism or infertility in some states, small group market reforms, solvency requirements for insurers, etc. Multi-state employers have to navigate both federal law and potentially dozens of different state laws for their insured benefits.
Complex indeed. Okay, maybe some quick examples could help illustrate this. How might things look for different size companies?
Sure. Let's take TechStart Solutions, a small startup, maybe 38 employees, limited HR resources, tight budget, needs to attract talent. Their challenge is finding affordable, appealing benefits, keeping admin simple. Solutions might involve a broker helping them find the right fit, maybe a level-funded plan, good tech for enrollment, focusing on a few key benefits done well.
Okay, small scale, affordability, simplicity, attraction. Midsize.
Midwest Manufacturing, 275 employees, maybe a couple locations, more complexity. They might be weighing a move to self-funding for health insurance to gain control. Challenges. Managing that transition, using claims data effectively, ensuring compliance across locations, communicating clearly. Solutions. Strong TPA partner, data analytics, robust admin platform, clear communication strategy.
Midsize. Complexity, data, potential self-funding. And large.
National Services Corporation, thousands of employees nationwide. Scale is the challenge. Huge diversity in workforce needs, complex multi-state compliance solutions, highly strategic benefits aligned with corporate goals, sophisticated data analysis, multiple plan options, dedicated benefits team, robust compliance program, advanced communication tools.
Scale dictates the complexity and sophistication needed.
Got it.
Finally, beyond plan design and compliance, what about just making these benefits work day to day? The administration.
Admin is huge. It's where the rubber meets the road for employees. You need solid implementation planning when starting or changing plans. Ongoing eligibility management is critical, tracking new hires, terms, status changes accurately. Dependent verification audits are often needed. Beneficiary management for life insurance needs to be up to date.
Lots of tracking.
Smooth enrollment administration, whether online or paper. Handling the annual renewal admin. Claims administration needs to be efficient and empathetic. Proper record retention for legal reasons, ongoing compliance checks, and maybe most importantly, clear, consistent, year-round communication so employees actually understand and value their benefits.
And how do employers manage all that?
They might use internal HR systems, specialized benefit administration software platforms, or systems provided by their insurance carriers or TPA. Self-service portals for employees are key now, and the whole ecosystem involves partners. the insurance carriers themselves, and often benefit consultants or brokers who help employers design plans, shop the market, select providers, and manage the ongoing process.
All support system behind the scenes.
Okay.
We have covered a ton of ground, from history to funding to regulations to admin. If you had to boil it down, what are the absolute key takeaways for our listener?
I'd say, one, the core idea of pooling risk is what makes group insurance work and offer value. Two, these benefits are no longer optional extras. They're a fundamental piece of your total compensation and financial security.
Right.
Three, the landscape is incredibly dynamic. Costs, regulations, technology, demographics are constantly changing it. And four, good plan design is only half the battle. Effective administration and clear communication are what make the benefits actually work for people.
Excellent summary. So it's complex, it's crucial, and it's constantly evolving. For you listening in, we really hope this deep dive give you those aha moments, that solid understanding without the overwhelm.
Yeah, hopefully demystified it a bit.
And maybe something to think about going forward. How will this constantly shifting world of group insurance continue to shape the future of work and maybe more importantly, your own financial security? Which trends that we talked about, rising costs, tech, voluntary benefits, regulatory changes, do you see having the biggest impact on you or your family?
It's definitely worth pondering.
Absolutely. This has really just scratched the surface, but hopefully it's a strong foundation. There are always more layers to explore if specific areas caught your interest. Keep digging.